Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Energy has never been in greater demand. Countries like China and India are rapidly industrialising, and as they become wealthier, their citizens are demanding more access to reliable electricity. And in the developed world, we continue to use vast amounts of power. To meet our power needs in coming decades, we need to think big. Next generation electricity transmission could well run on a series of supergrids, an electrical infrastructure challenge not seen since the post-war period. I'm Gaia Vince, and in this edition of Discovery from the BBC, I'm going to look at the future grid. As well as getting electricity to people when they need it, a supergrid helps us in the move to a low-carbon future, using energy generated from sources such as the sun or wind. Jonathan Gaventa of energy consultancy 3EG.
One of the sources of benefit is the renewable resources, your wind and your solar plants, can be located where the best resources are, where the wind is blowing the strongest, where the sun is shining the brightest. And you put your PV panels in Spain or southern Italy, for example, and you concentrate your wind farms around the edges of the North Sea where it's cold and wet and windy. But that's really only part of the story. It's a part of the story that a lot of people gather. But the second real source of benefit is it means you have to use less backup plant. So basically, the wind doesn't blow everywhere all of the time, but it blows somewhere most of the time. And when, in particular, when you combine it with solar, with geothermal, with other sources, if you can add all those together at a continental scale, it means you don't have to run your expensive gas plant, your expensive coal plant nearly as often. So there's some big financial savings there as well.
In the UK and other countries in the developed world, electricity grids linking power stations to homes and workplaces were built during the first half of the 20th century. Power travels over high-voltage wires strung from pylons, or they're buried under the ground. The electricity is moved around as alternating current, or AC. It's easy to change the voltage if the current is alternating, and it's cheaper to transport electricity at high voltage over long-distance wires. This has become the standard way for moving electricity over distances up to around 500 miles or 800 kilometres. In the 19th century, proponents of alternating current won out over those who wanted to use direct current, or DC. DC is the form of current you get out of a battery. But DC may be returning if we want a bigger grid. Professor John Loughhead, Director of the UK Energy Research Centre.
Once you try to transmit above distances of about 400 to 500 miles, then the alternating current transmission becomes ineffective for all kinds of technical reasons to do with electromagnetic behaviour. DC is more expensive as a system to build, but has much lower losses as you increase the distance. And therefore, if you want to transmit large distances, DC is the way to do it. It becomes a little more complicated than that in big networks, because what you do is you wouldn't necessarily transmit electricity from, say, North Africa to Scotland. What you'd do is generate electricity in North Africa. That would probably be used somewhere in France and Spain. That would reduce the demand on their power station, so the electrons they're producing will travel further north. So it's rather like a shunting of a train up. And the key is to work out how, from a total system point of view, you can do that most effectively. Because what you're not doing is transmitting electricity generated in one place, say 2,000 miles away, to where you want to use it. You would use the rest of the system to optimise the performance.
So for the supergrid of the future, DC is making a comeback. For Britain, an island nation, planning is underway for a subsea grid to connect us better to the continent. 10 kilometres and beyond, off the island, there are a number of large wind farms. As Jonathan Gaventa points out, connecting to wind farms a long way offshore presents an opportunity to look at how a much grander supergrid might work.
So the concept of a North Seas grid is really at the forefront for how people are seeing the European grid evolving in the future. At the moment, there's an initiative with 10 different countries around the North Seas region who have agreed to cooperate and to try to see if they can overcome some of those regulatory barriers that are there at the moment to make an integrated grid work across the North Sea, both connecting different offshore wind farms from different countries back to shore, but also connecting all those different countries together so they can share resources and trade more freely. And this is the type of template that we see happening across Europe in future, not just in terms of getting the regulation right and getting the political cooperation right, but some of the technologies in terms of the HVDC cables are the same that are likely to be used in future.
At Imperial College London, Tim Green, Professor of Electrical Engineering, is working on the sorts of control technologies that a genuine DC grid might require.
We are certainly in the early stages where we're mostly building individual links, but they are beginning not maybe to connect in DC terms, but to give us options on how we move power. The early stages are consenting for the big Dogger Bank wind farm. That's about a third of the way out into the North Sea towards Norway. So the thinking is that after we've built cables from Dogger Bank to the UK, if we build also some cables from Dogger Bank to Norway, now we have some options. And then we build out from there. We maybe start to connect the East Coast wind farms together, Dogger Bank to Hornsea and further south. Each of those have their links into the United Kingdom, but I could also link to the Netherlands and to Germany. And then we start to have options as to where we sell renewable energy when we have a surplus and where we buy from when we have a deficit.
And wind farms actually are ideal for this super grid because they're located sometimes hundreds of kilometres offshore. So we need that direct current.
We need that direct current because those renewable resources are by their nature a long way from the major cities and the demand centres.
High voltage direct current, or HVDC, is more efficient over long distances, ideal for crossing the North Sea expanse. But with national grids and our homes and offices all running on AC, the DC has to be converted, and that incurs losses. Tim Green again.
The first step that was realised many years ago, to be efficient you need to go to very high voltages, because going to high voltages means transmitting the power with less current, and the power losses come principally from the flow of current in the wires. The extra thing that we now add on to that is when you use subsea cables, the conductors are placed very close together. If you have in your mind an electricity tower, a pylon, the conductors are hanging from arms that are tens of metres apart. Instead, we're now going to put them very close together, separated by a few centimetres of plastic. It changes their electrical characteristics. It gives them a lot more capacitance. They store charge. And the current you need to store charge in that capacitance and discharge it as you go through the alternating cycles is large. That eats into your capacity to ship power. You use your current to charge and discharge the capacitance rather than ship power. You sidestep that if you run the thing on DC. So now we've got a more efficient way of running our cables. The difficulty is at the two ends we have to convert between the AC systems of the land-based networks and the DC of the cable. So we have quite large, quite high power converters at the two ends to convert between DC and AC.
While work continues to make HVDC technology cheaper to install, others are looking at a fundamentally different approach to transporting electricity. Instead of metal cables, the wires of the future grid could be made from carbon nanotubes.
So here I have, this is the first ever carbon Ethernet cable, which we have produced in my lab. It's 65 centimeter long. It consists of four carbon nanotube wires. Each of them is a millimeter diameter wire.
Wow. It's amazing, and it feels like a plastic or even a fabric material like cotton or something. I mean, I can screw it up in my hand. It's very unmetallic.
Yes, we often compare it to cotton.
The wires that Christoph Koziol at Cambridge University has made are pure carbon, made of billions of tiny nanotubes.
Only carbon atoms, and the important thing is how these carbon atoms are joined together. They are connected in hexagonal structure. People often will describe it as a chicken wire-like structure. And then this sort of structure is rolled into a tubular form, and you end up with a carbon nanotube.
And what's so special about a carbon nanotube? Why are you trying so desperately to make them?
The exciting thing about the material are the properties. And that's because the physics that that we understand in bulk materials, it's different to what we see in these nanomaterials, specifically the way how electrons are transported through this material, the conduction mechanism, the heat transfer, the lightness of the material, and also the raw materials that we use to make these structures, because you need something like natural gas or carbon dioxide to make those nanostructures.
A single nanotube has similar properties to a superconductor, the long-dreamt-of wonder material that currently only works at impracticably cold temperatures. Christoph's wire, though, is made of many billions of short millimetre-length nanotubes strung together, with each connection adding some resistance. But his team is making impressive progress on constructing longer nanotube units. A millimetre may not sound long, but the nanotube is already a million times longer than it is wide.
That's correct. They are about a nanometer in diameter and a millimeter in length.
And a millimeter seems absolutely minuscule for something that we're trying to make a wire out of. But in 2008, when you first started this research, I mean, how big were they then?
We were working at micron-size long tubes and trying to develop the process to make them as long as possible. And we managed to arrive at the millimeter length.
So you've already gone 1,000 times longer.
Yes.
And the length of this nanotube is dictated by the catalyst.
Yes, the catalyst is a quite important part of the synthesis process. And as a seed, it basically takes carbon from the surrounding and extrudes the nanotube through the catalyst. So at the point when the catalyst becomes poisoned or stops working, then this is where the length of the tube is defined.
So if that catalyst could continue working eternally, you could eventually get the dream of an entire wire made out of one carbon nanotube. And that, of course, would mean nobody would be using copper anymore.
This is the dream that we would like to realise, to make the individual tubes as long as possible and therefore being able to get the properties that we see at the individual nanotube in the macroscopic wires.
Incredible. Well, you've already managed to increase the length by 1,000 times in just 5 or 6 years. So who knows what's possible in the future?
Yes, we'll see.
Wires made not from copper but from carbon would be lighter, stronger and more conductive. But they are a long way off being used to transport continental amounts of energy. However, one other grid we do already have in place all around the world, over land and undersea, is made not from copper but from glass.
In this box we have, starting with a laser, which is a crystal itself, then we start off by using that crystal to convert electricity into light. And that light is then travelling through an optical fibre, and the optical fibre is our replacement for a wire, essentially.
Stephen Sweeney and his team at the University of Surrey are looking at ways of using light rather than electricity to transmit power.
This optical fibre is carrying that light from that laser, and it's infrared light, actually, and it comes to the end of the fibre, and then it emits it from the end, and then underneath it we have a photovoltaic cell. From that, we're generating electrical current. So the electrical current is then being taken off in our circuit to where we're measuring it and then using it. And it's from that that we can actually measure how well the cell is converting the light into electricity.
So this is the same as a standard circuit. You're putting the electricity in, you're taking the electricity out of the other end and measuring it. But instead of using a copper wire, you're using photonics, you're using light.
That's right. So we're replacing the part in the middle with light, essentially, and for all of the benefits in terms of how easily we can transmit the light without radiation, electromagnetic effects, etc., and the fact that we can use very small fibres. So that's the other interesting thing about it. If you look at the thickness of a cable for transmitting power and you compare it with the thickness of an optical fibre, these are very thin, because it's not limited by the thickness.
So that fibre that we see in the small circuit could actually be scaled up massively, and it could be under the North Sea, or it could be, I guess, held on telegraph poles to transmit power along large distance using light.
In principle, these optical fibres, yes, for transmitting power under the sea, you could use the fibre across an ocean, which is very similar to what we do already with data. So we've got actually millions of kilometres of fibre across the Earth transmitting information. And so it's a very similar thing. We might have to modify it slightly, but it's essentially the same idea. in talk about telegraph poles, of course, you could actually dispense with the fibre. You could just have the light travelling through the air between the poles.
The frequency of light that Stephen is working with is ideal for optical fibres, but it is also ideal and safe for transmitting and receiving power through air and through space. They have been working with Astrium, now owned by Airbus, on the idea of beaming electricity back from vast Earth-orbiting solar arrays.
OK, so in this setup we have a mock-up of what we might expect to see in one of these transmission systems. So this end of the table we have a laser, and this is generating our light, and you might imagine that's on your satellite. The other end of the table we have our photovoltaic cell, and that could be represent our ground station where we'll be generating power. So if we now switch on the laser, then we should be able to see that there's power.
Oh, the motor's started. Brilliant, brilliant.
So we've now transmitted the power, and you can't see it because it's an infrared beam as well. That's coming down to the photovoltaic cell, and all that's between the photovoltaic cell and that motor is just the wires. So the photovoltaic cell is converting the light into electrical energy, and then the motor is just converting it into motion.
So what would happen if I put something in the way? Is it safe? Can I put my hand?
Yeah, it's safe. It's a safe
Okay,
beam.
So if I put my hand in the way of the beam, I can't actually see the beam, so... Ah, and the motor stopped. Brilliant. Okay, I'm going to lift it away again. And it started. Goodness. Okay. So essentially that beam is the copper wire of the future.
Exactly.
The idea of electrical transmission grids that extend up into orbit, made of laser wires or carbon nanotubes, is still some way off. But an idea more down to earth and close to hand is to combine the properties of copper and carbon into a single ultra wire.
The idea is to develop an ultra conductive copper with carbon nanotubes and graphene being part of the copper wire. And the idea is to reduce the copper weight, improving thermoconductivity, increasing the mechanical strength, and also flexibility of copper wires. So putting the properties of these two materials together and creating one.
So this ultra wire, does it remove the problem of the joins between carbon nanotubes because the electricity can simply flow through the copper material at that point?
We are looking whether this would be a solution to remove the junctions. Or another option could be that the current would still flow through the copper matrix, but the nanotubes will provide the other properties to this hybrid wire.
So a midway point between achieving full carbon nanotubes for wires might be these hybrid wires, this ultra wire.
Yes, this could be something that may happen quite quickly and will arrive to the market after maybe a couple of years of the development in this project.
Fairly soon then. So there are new materials and new ideas that could transform the way of moving power around the world. But in the short term, there are large-scale projects to bring power from one country to another using current technology. One consortium that got a lot of publicity a few years ago was Desertec. Its aim was to cover a lot of North African desert with photovoltaic cells and bring the electricity to Europe. But it abandoned its plans in 2013. There was already a surplus of renewable energy in southern Europe, and the grid between North Africa and Europe wasn't robust enough. But as Jonathan Gaventa says, the idea is not dead.
I think the Desertec concept is still alive and kicking. The sun is still shining very brightly in the Sahara. I think the project developers have learned some valuable lessons in the last few years. I think the initial idea was that we could just build some big solar plants and then ship it all directly to Europe. But what's changed in that time is electricity demand is growing in Northern Europe much less slowly than it was expected. And it's growing much more quickly in Northern Africa than was expected as well. So I think the new Desertec concepts need to pay as much attention to the power demand in North Africa and the potential for trading both directions rather than just wholesale shipping things from North Africa up to the UK or to Germany.
So in the future, this protectionist European idea of, first of all, single nations producing their own electricity for their own use is going to expand to the European continent and then further, so that geographically electricity can be produced but also used over a much bigger region.
I think that's right. There's already some really exciting plans in the pipeline to link to places like Iceland, where there's very strong geothermal energy. There's a lot of interest in linking the rest of Europe much more strongly with Turkey, which has lots of solar and wind resources. And also areas of the Western Balkans, for example, have a lot of underutilized hydro resources, which again can help as a source of storage and backup for the intermittent resources.
Getting supergrids to work demands in-depth knowledge about where power is being generated and where it is needed. And perhaps it will be in East Asia, where we'll see the first long-distance modern grid. John Loughhead has kept an eye on developments in this part of the world. China's rapid development has made it hungry for electricity, but the country's main sources of power are in the West, whereas the main users are thousands of kilometres away in the East. The Chinese have a lot of catching up to do when it comes to power grids.
The difference between Europe and China is that Europe has got electricity networks all over Europe, so there's an infrastructure in place and users everywhere. In China, you've got the very large deposits of coal in the west and northwest, and as you've said, all the users in the east. So you need either to transport the coal over the 2,500 kilometres between the two and then burn it where all the people are, or you generate the electricity and transmit the electricity. And there's hardly anybody in between that needs to use it. And therefore, it becomes much more practical to build a high-voltage direct current transmission system to take it from the extreme west to the extreme east and then turn it into a form that people can use in their houses and businesses.
Has that actually been built? I mean, is there a cable from the Gobi to Shanghai or to Beijing at the moment?
The Chinese are installing HVDC systems at the moment, and they've done quite a lot of work themselves to develop many of the technical requirements of that system, although they still do this in partnership with Western companies who've got the technology of some of the key solid-state power switching devices that are essential to make HVDC work. But it is something that China's developing as part of a portfolio of measures. They're trying to get more efficient transfer from the West. They've got a massive renewable energy program deployment system, and so they've got a challenge about how to integrate that renewable energy into their system. Massive hydroelectric schemes and a big deployment now of new nuclear power stations that they're looking at.
So are they really the pioneers of HVDC? Are they the people that we should be watching and learning from as we attempt our own programmes?
They are not quite the pioneers, because HVDC has been used in Canada, in Europe, for something like 30 or 40 years, using a previous generation of technologies. China, however, is the place where the next phase of large-scale deployment is going to happen. And China will almost certainly deploy more HVDC than we've seen in the West so far. So inevitably, that's where the bulk of the technology will start to be developed. And from the experience of rolling out these large systems, they're going to produce new information and insights that we hopefully will benefit from. There's quite a close collaboration between China and Europe and the United States and North America. So there's a lot of information exchange. So if you like, they're going to be the test bed for the next generation.
And it's beyond China in a way, isn't it? Because China is also buying up parts of hydroelectric potential in neighbouring Asian countries to transmit back. And Thailand, Laos, Vietnam and so on will need, I suppose, some sort of supergrid of their own.
And in fact, they're already starting to develop that. The countries in Southeast Asia, who tend to get slightly less attention than China, are actually a major area for electricity consumption growth in the future, because at the moment they don't have good supply systems, but they've got rapidly expanding economies, and there is as much going on there as there is in China. It's just slightly less visible. So yes, I'm sure that we will see interconnections between China and those other regions, as well as connections already being built between countries such as Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, as you say.
And back in Europe, the place where electricity grids were born, will there actually be an agreement to build the supergrid? Jonathan Gaventer again.
Well, I think it's important to consider that there's never going to be one single decision of, yes, we're going to build a supergrid, or no, we're not going to build a supergrid. Inevitably, it's going to happen project by project, wire by wire, essentially. I think the plans that have already begun to go through at the moment show that there's lots of investment happening after 2030 towards 2040, 2050. By 2050, the expectation is we can have an energy system that's much better connected, HVDC connections across the North Sea to begin with, both to link up the offshore wind farms, but then to cross over the sea and between countries, link straight from the wind farm over to other countries. And that is really seen as a first sort of stepping stone towards a more European-wide grid with the ability to trade from Madrid to Riga, if that's the way that the economics works, but to have at least enough connection and capacity to enable that to happen. A number of studies have shown it's entirely technically possible to move even towards 100% renewables system in Europe by 2050. But to make that happen, a lot of attention needs to go into the grid infrastructure is needed, both the large-scale supergrid, but also the intelligent smart grid aspects of that as well, the control systems for the grid to make sure that it can react and send the power to where it's needed most.
And what are the biggest challenges to getting this idea, this dream of an interconnected Europe realised?
The challenge doesn't seem to be financial, because compared to the overall costs of the investment that's going to be required out to 2050, the transmission system, the grid system, is really only a small proportion of that. So that's not the principal barrier. The principal barrier isn't technology either, because all of the technologies for HVDC cables are already pretty well known and are beginning to be deployed more and more in countries across the world. So the problem really seems to be political. It's about getting different countries to be able to work together to combine different regulatory systems and different energy policies in different countries so that it's closely aligned enough for the wires to be built.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.